Well, it may not be possible to travel back in time, at least yet, but seeing stars and galaxies as they looked millions or even billions of years ago is no problem thanks to telescopes, the closest thing we have to time machines. Now astronomers are holding their breath to see what they'll observe and discover with a new generation of huge telescopes set to be built around the world. In 2008, expect some major telescopes in Hawaii and in Chile. Things that will allow us to look way back into time. Up next, scientist Nassim Hiramain joins us live from France as we talk about the universe on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I'm looking forward to tonight. Nassim Hiramain has spent most of his life researching the geometry of hyperspace, theoretical physics, cosmology, quantum mechanics, biology, chemistry, as well as anthropology and ancient civilizations. Combining this knowledge with an incredible observation of the behavior of nature, he discovered a specific geometric array that he found to be fundamental to creation and the foundation for his unified field theory. Mr. Hiramain founded a not-for-profit organization, the Resonance Project Foundation, where as the director of research, he continues exploring unification principles and their implications in our world today. He travels worldwide, specifically the U.S., Canada, talking about his theories. Here he is, full program tonight on Coast to Coast. Nassim, how are you, sir?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You know, I've had so many people over the last 6 months have been sending me email messages and phone calls wanting to get you on the program, and I finally had to break down because they're right. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you very much. I'm glad they're asking. That means they're interested, and there's certainly a lot of interest out there.
Tell me about yourself, Nassim. How did you get interested in this whole field?
It started very early. I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I had an experience at school that kind of launched me into exploring the nature of reality.
Whatever that reality is, huh?
Right. And basically, it was my first lesson in geometry, and the teacher taught us about dimensions. And he made a dot on the blackboard and said, the dot is dimension zero and it doesn't exist. And as soon as he said that, I already had an issue. Because if I could see the dot, how was it that it didn't exist? And then he put a bunch of dots together, made a line, and said, that's dimension one, and it still doesn't exist because it doesn't enclose volume. And then he put four lines together to make a plane and called it 2D and said it still didn't enclose volume, and so it didn't exist. And then all of a sudden he took six of these non-existing planes, put them together into a cube, and said, this encloses volume, it's dimension three, and it's the one that you exist in. And that just didn't make sense to me. And so it kind of started me on this adventure about trying to find a solution to that problem. I didn't know at the time that this axiom was the foundation of most of our physics. I mean, Einstein's field equations are written on flat space, and so is quantum theory, and mm-hmm. so on. And but I didn't know all these things. I just felt like there was a deeper meaning to dimensions than just axiom based on not a complete picture. And so I was looking into it, and I had this intuition. I was in this bus going back home, and I thought about it, and I escaped my bus in my mind's eye, and I rose above the bus, and I saw the bus becoming a dot, and I rose further, and I saw the Earth becoming a dot, and I rose further, and I saw the solar system becoming a dot, and I rose further, and I saw the galaxy becoming a dot, and I thought, wow, it could be dots all the way up. And then I flew back into the galaxy and into the solar system and back into my bus and opened my eyes and looked at my hand, and I thought, wow, you know, I wonder what's in there. And I, you know, closed my eyes, and in my mind's eye, flew into my hand, and I saw the cells that we're made of, and, you know, there's millions and millions of them, and billions, and I saw that they looked like dots, and then I flew onto the surface of one cell and looked really, really closely, and I saw millions and millions and billions of little dots we call atoms, and then I flew into the middle of one of those, and I saw a dot in the middle, and I thought, wow, it could be dots all the way down. You know, there was a dot in the middle of the atom, and I imagined there could be dots, you know, dividing that dot and so on. And I opened my eyes, and I was so excited. I was like 9 or 10 years old, and I felt like I had found something very fundamental, very crucial.
You were only that age when you were starting to put this together?
Well, yeah.
That's fantastic.
I found out later that many children have had the same problem at school when they were taught that axiom. Actually, Buckminster Fuller had this same issue that he mentioned later on, and turns out that my father had the same issue when he was taught that lesson at school. And, you know, and I just felt like there was a way to solve it. And when I had this vision, this moment of illumination, I came back to my bus and opened my eyes, and I looked at people around me, and I kind of had a feeling that they were like made out of dots that were made out of dots that were made out of dots to infinity. And I there was a glow around them almost that I could see. And I was really, really excited. And it started me on this adventure into trying to find a solution to describe our world in this infinite division function, in this fractal division of the space to infinity.
Did you find this that you were alone in this thought, or that there were others that believed the same things?
I at the time certainly I was. I found I was really alone in that thought. And actually, you know, when you have this great insight, typically you want to tell someone. And you know how that goes usually. You know, you get the looks. And so I ran home and I told my mom about it. And I said, Mom, I think they're wrong at school about dimensions. I think the only thing that exists is the dot. And it's the exact contrary axiom, and that the dot is divisible to infinity. And she looked at me and she said, you know, I don't feel infinite right now. And if you answer that at the school test, you're going to fail geometry. And but she had made a very important point, is that if everything was divided in such a way, if everything has infinity in it, how do we get distinction? How do we get finite boundaries? You know, our world seems to be built on finite boundaries. And I had to think about that, and that took me some 20 years to figure out, you know, because actually that fundamental problem between infinities and finite boundary is the chasm that's dividing our physics today. We have a theory for the big stuff that's called relativistic equations that are famous because Einstein wrote them.
Sure.
And
you remind me of Einstein a little bit.
Thank you.
You're the younger version, of course.
I'm glad. you know, those equations actually describe the big stuff, the movement of stars and galaxies and the gravitational effects that they have, and planetary orbits and so on. And then we have quantum theory that describe small stuff like the atom and subatomic particles and the way they interact and their fields and all this stuff. But they don't agree, those two theories don't agree. Einstein's field equations predict continuums towards infinity, towards singularity.
Uh-huh.
And quantum theory predicts finite boundaries, linear functions. quantum numbers, and these don't agree together. And so now we have a theory that describes the big stuff that's made out of small stuff, because all the big stuff is made out of atoms. And the theory that we have for the small stuff doesn't agree with the theory for the big stuff.
And it should, shouldn't it?
It should, absolutely. Well, you know, Einstein thought it should, and many other scientists thought it should, but it's like almost 100 years ago, people kind of went along with the idea that they could be two theories, and it became the standard that you can't deal with the atomic level with Einstein field equation, and you can't deal with the large stuff with quantum theory. And thus started this great quest from certain scientists, and certainly Einstein for the rest of his life, to find a theory that would unify the two. And in the case of Einstein, Einstein was clear that there must be some fundamental mechanical function at the source of reality that would unify these theories. And he didn't agree much with quantum theory, because quantum theory is based on axioms that are not based on sound mechanical functions. Einstein thought there must be some underlying geometric fundamental patterns of creation that could be expressed mathematically and theoretically that would unify our understanding of creation.
Did these theories, Nassim, the theories we're going to talk about at the great depth with you tonight, did they ever get to the point where they answered for you those major questions that we are all confronted by, and that is, who are we, what are we, why are we here, what happened to the Big Bang, was there a Big Bang? Were you ever able to get these answers for your own curiosity?
Absolutely. Actually, you know, and it's a big statement, because the question you're asking are very, you know, fundamental and primal questions. And certainly the way the mathematics and the physics I've been writing and the philosophy that can be extracted from it and so on has answered many of some of the most fundamental questions people have about their existence and what is the universe, how does it work, how did they get to be here, what is consciousness, what is the role of consciousness in reality, and all these questions that we're basically born with. I think from the first instance that we can remember, typically, you know, these questions arise.
Sure.
I have a four-year-old that, you know, I've been touring for a few months now, and I was driving across the country, across the desert in Nevada, and he was sitting beside me in the car, and he all of a sudden, out of the blue, asked me, well, after asking, you know, he's in the why moment.
Just like you were.
Yeah, exactly. And he asked me, what is reality, Papa? And, you know, that kind of took me back.
4 years old?
4 years old.
Gosh, he's 54 years ahead of me. I haven't even asked you that one yet.
Well, you know, I think these questions arise fairly soon. And I think if the question's there, there is an answer for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Do you find that now, you, of course, a great thinker, but there are a lot of scientists out there, Nassim, who just don't put it all together. You know, no need to mention names, but they don't seem to understand the tie-in between, as you say, consciousness, who are we, what are we, and the rest of the universe. I mean, they're so science-oriented, they don't look at the bigger picture.
Yes. Well, you know, I think, you know, that chasm I was talking about mm-hmm. between a relativistic equation and quantum theory, I think that's even deeper than that. you know, the one predicts infinities and the other one boundary condition. Well, it's a deeper chasm. Typically the scientific world look at things in finite boundaries, linear function, closed system, and the people that are a little more spiritual tend to see things in more like infinite potential, infinite possibilities, and so on. And, you know, I think at this time it's important that the two get together. And I think a new level of science is going to emerge from that merging of these two thoughts. But you would be surprised the change that's occurring in the scientific world at this time. It's remarkable. 15 years ago, when I was going to physics conference, it was so crucial that you never, ever uttered the C word. You know, if you said consciousness in a physics meeting, you'd get ostracized on the spot. Now, it's becoming very popular for some of the most advanced physicists and well-known scientists to, you know, do very good research on trying to find where consciousness fits in the picture and how it has an influence on matter and so on. And so there is more and more willingness to look at it, and I think there's quite a bit of openness that's occurring.
Nassim, I've got to ask you, and we're going to take a break in about a minute or so, and we'll come right back, but you bring up some incredible things in your DVD series, Crossing the Event Horizon, Rise to the Equation, where you talk about ancient civilizations and, you know, their work. How did they know the incredible things they knew without high technology, assuming they didn't have it?
Right. Well, you know, we need a little more time to discuss that. But basically, if you study ancient texts, and so did Isaac Newton. Newton spent a lot of time studying ancient texts and ancient civilization long before he wrote stuff on physics. But you find that there is sets of information in there that seems to relate to very advanced knowledge, very advanced physics. And when you study a lot of their monuments and the sites, the ancient sites around the world, then you find all sorts of anomalies of extremely large stones that have been moved very long distances over rivers and mountains and, you know, stones that we couldn't lift today with the largest cranes on Earth.
True.
You know, there's all sorts of bizarre things you find around the world like this. And if there was like one or, you know, you could say, well, it's an anomaly, but like there's many, 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 like thousands of these different examples. And some of these examples go back now, you know, with new sites that are being found almost 10,000 years ago. And so there's evidence, you know, and I'm going to say this loosely, there's evidence that there was very advanced knowledge on our planet long prior to our written history, and that we may have something to learn about what they left for us at this time.
Let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back. Nassim Hedermain's website, The Resonance, and I'll spell it, R-E-S-O-N-A-N-C-E, theresonanceproject.org. His website is pretty remarkable. So if you haven't had an opportunity to get it, we've also made it easy for you. There's a direct link at ours, coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. With our special guest tonight, Nassim Hedermain, as we talk about things going on in the universe. More to come on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Nassim Hedermain. Nassim, if they had this high technology, where do you think they got it?
Well, you know, when you look at our universe, and if you do an analysis, not so long ago, we thought there would be very low chances for other planets with life out there, because we thought there was not much water around in our universe. And, you know, water is one of the fundamental building blocks for life to emerge, at least life the way we know it. And so, you know, we thought there was probably not many planets out there with life. But since then, maybe in the last 15 years, we've had all sorts of equipment scanning our night sky. And when we look around, actually, we have a really hard time finding places in the universe where water is not present. We see spectral lines of water everywhere we look. And so our universe seems to be abundant with water. We even see clouds of organic material flying around. I mean, there is all sorts of evidence that the building blocks for life are out there in abundance. And then as well, in the last 10 years, we've discovered many stars seem to have planets orbiting them much more than we expected they would be. And we're getting better and better at observing these planetary systems. And so since there's much more planets than we thought there was, and there's much more water than we thought there was, you know, the possibility of life is very, very high. And now look at our civilization. Look at the developments that we undergo, that we have undergone in the last, 150 years?
It's been dramatic.
It's amazing. We went from horse and buggy to going to the moon and, you know, although, so, you know, flying around and
we may have gone to the moon in a buggy, it seems, sometimes, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, you know, our technological advancements are still precarious. I mean, we're burning fossil fuel to get anywhere, but we can go around our planet pretty easily. People get on a plane, they don't think about it twice, they go across the world and so on. I mean, this is tremendous in 150 years of development. Imagine a planet that evolved earlier than us and that got maybe 1,000 years
yes.
of technological development. Where would they be? How fast would their computer run? You know, when you think about it, most likely those planetary systems would have figured out how to use the force of nature, forces in nature, and maybe overcome gravity, maybe find a way to warp space and time, and be able to travel very, very large distances, something that we can't conceive today, but that may be just around the corner for us as well. And in a society like this, and since there may be thousands and thousands of these civilizations out there, it's not unreasonable to think that maybe our planet was discovered very early on by advanced civilization, and that these advanced civilizations bestowed the inhabitants of our planet with some information. And when you look around in ancient civilization and you study them and you look at their writings and you look at their monuments and what they left for us, they all talk about these sun gods that came from the stars, that brought them all they know about civilization. None of these ancient civilization claims to have come up with all the knowledge they have. They all said it came from these sun gods.
Yes. They point up, Nassim, all the time. You know, when you talk about, you know, where did you get this information? They always point toward the sky.
Exactly. And they as well say that these people taught them how to build the buildings they built, and that they helped them do that, and that, you know, that they learned mathematics and that they learned writing from them and all this stuff. So You know, it's overwhelming when you do the research because it's everywhere. I mean, some 300 different civilizations around the world talks about these sun gods coming from the stars. And so I believe they might have been a contact very early on. And when you combine this with more modern history, where you find, you know, even from the Middle Ages on, that there's reports of people seeing, you know, flying objects and all these, I mean, millions and millions of people over time.
Sure.
You know, and now governments that are releasing, you know, top secret files about UFOs activity and so on, and some of the most trusted military personnel coming forward and talking about these things, you know, it starts to become a very convincing argument.
Do you believe that they left us, or might they still be here?
I think they're still here. I mean, there's still so many people that see them. There's so many reports. And like I said, some of the reports come from very entrusted people, military personnel and airline jet pilots and so on. And, you know, I think that they're still around, and they might be waiting for us to reach a level of consciousness, a level of awareness where we're more harmonious and maybe a little less violent.
Are you a believer in some intelligent design, or do you believe that whatever happened here, even though there may be thousands if not millions of civilizations out there, that they weren't developed randomly? Somebody had to have started it or something.
Well, that brings us right into actually the core of the work I'm doing. You know, I think that this is a big issue in our civilization currently. You have the scientific world on one side that's saying, you know, it's all random. And you have the spiritual world on the other side saying there's some God that's organizing everything, or at least the religious world. You know, the two don't agree. And, you know, and on both sides of the fence, you find good arguments. I mean, certainly, when you look at our world and the biology of our world, the biosphere is very highly organized. I mean, it's extremely complex. And, you know, I always give this example. I mean, the complexity of one human being is remarkable. If I took all the DNA inside your body, George, and I pulled it out and I strung it end to end, I could wrap it around the world 5 million times. You know, that's how much DNA information network that's present inside your body, like all compactify, all talking to each other, all working all the information out so that, you know, your cell divide appropriately, and their division is very rapid. And if that didn't work out well, you know, all of a sudden you could be starting to grow a nose on your toe and a toe on your nose, and, you know, it would be very uncomfortable to have a nose in your shoe. you know, that's remarkable, and it demands something more than random function. In fact, if you look at the complexity of one blade of grass with all its microbial life, and you try to calculate how this could have occurred in random function since the Big Bang, it doesn't work out. It exceeds the Big Bang. So, in some ways, it makes sense that there's some kind of organizing factor. But if you're asking me if I believe in some God that's doing all this, I would say absolutely not. What I believe in is that there is a feedback. And I'm going to give you an example.
Okay.
If you were to give a Rubik's Cube to a blind man, which is not a really nice thing to do.
But no, but he'd probably do it better than I would.
And he could move the cube once every second. and you ask him to order it, because he doesn't know if he's getting closer or further from the solution, you can write the probabilities on how long it could take him to order it.
Right.
And when you do that at one move every second, you know, the probabilities are so large that you exceed the Big Bang, 14 billion years.
True. I mean, infinitesimal odds, yeah, I would believe.
It's very, very large. And so, but if you tell the blind man every time he makes a move, yes, you're getting closer, or no, you're getting further, then within 2.5 minutes, you will have the cube ordered. So this is a remarkable change in length of time. So what I believe is that there's actually a mechanism of feedback in our universe, that is, that there is information going out into the universe, and there's information coming in from the universe. There's a relationship, there's a feedback, so that the system knows what it's doing. It knows what everything in the universe is doing, how it's organizing, what works and what doesn't work. Like you see it in nature. When nature finds something that doesn't work or doesn't work anymore because the elements are changing, because the environment is changing, it slowly gets rid of it. And so, you know, what I'm saying is that there is an element of feedback, and that feedback is due to the relationship that we have between the atomic structure and the space around it. And I need to give more details about that so that it's understood.
And also, you know, there's so many things I want to talk with you about that are all related, one of which is everything in the universe, Nassim, seems to be so orderly. It all seems to be so proper. You know, yes, we just found out there's a planet that spins the wrong way. That's not very usual. That is very unusual. But by and large, there seems to be order, and everything's the same in the universe. I'm convinced that on other planets and other systems, they probably have similar elements like we have too, don't you?
Yeah, most likely, at least in our, you know, in our section of the universe.
Yes.
And, you know, I think as well that this orderly fashion that we see everywhere, that's very good observation, you know, is due to a connectivity between all things, that things are not necessarily as separate as they appear to be.
I want to get your thoughts on the multiverse. Some scientists are now beginning to say that we have more than one universe. We have many. What do you think?
I would agree with that. I would say that we are probably embedded into a larger universe, which is embedded into a larger one, and so on. And I believe, based on the fractal nature of my theory, that those embeddedness go to infinity, from infinitely big or to infinitely small, which was basically the concept that struck me when I was 10 years old in that bus, is that you can divide to infinity, or you can go infinitely large if you want to, but that each boundary is embedded into a larger one, so that you can't actually separate anything from anything else.
Would you think that these universes are all the same? Or might they have different life forms that are totally different than what we can even comprehend?
I would say that they most likely have similar properties. However, they might be different to us. I'll explain that. Let's say you were an atom, and first of all, let me make clear that when I'm thinking of multiverses, I'm not thinking of universes that are separate from us, but that our universe is embedded into a larger one and a larger one and a larger one.
Like bubbles stuck together?
Exactly, like bubbles within each other.
Okay.
And so imagine that I shrunk you Or let's say that you were an atom, and or even a cell, a biological cell, and you observe the universe from that perspective, from that level of scale. Your universe, your space would look quite different. You know, it wouldn't look anything like what you're experiencing today. But you know, then if I grew you to the size of a human being, and then you looked around, you would think you probably changed dimensions. Well, you actually literally changed dimensions in size, you know. But you would think you probably went to another universe or something. But actually, all you've done is observe things from a different perspective. So another universe, a much larger universe than the one we're in, might look quite different, but maybe it would be just different because it would be at a different scale. We would look at a different perspective on the same thing.
Good point. And I have to applaud you for your thought. I mean, you get it. There aren't a lot of people who have put this together the way you have. And I know we've only scratched it just this first hour. More
thank
to come,
you.
But you get it, and it's refreshing.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I think more and more people get it. I was amazed at you know, the quality and the depth of thought that that's emerging in the scientific world, in the physics conferences I attend, and so on. It's really remarkable. I think we're really undergoing a transformation at this time, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, it sure is. And we're going to talk about the Resonance Project when we come back. Do you travel much now still? You're in France. I know you go to the United States a lot. Where are you based primarily now?
I'm based in Hawaii, on Kauai.
Oh, are you? Sure. I've got a lot of friends on the Big Island.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, it's a beautiful place to be. And I'm traveling right now. You're correct. I'm talking from La Côte d'Azur near Nice in France, and I've been touring for almost 3 months now. And yeah, a lot of interest out there, and there's a lot of great thinking that's going on. It's really remarkable.
Get down to Monaco and say hi to Prince Albert for me. You know, it's fun.
I don't know if they'll have me.
Of course they will. With your mind, of course they will. You know, you're like the new Albert Einstein or the new Carl Sagan. Did you know that?
Thank you. Yes, it's a great honor to be associated with these people. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk about this project, the Resonance Project, and what it means, and also how consciousness, again, ties into your theories. It is truly remarkable. Crossing the Event Horizon, Rise to the Equation. That's his DVD set. Fascinating. Fascinating. I'll be back.